Hello and welcome to the Dan with Pat podcast, episode 477. I'm your host, Ryan Johnson. Sick again. I'm always sick.
You're always licking those handrails at the mall.
I wish they didn't taste so good.
Oh,
bubblegum.
Fuck me. That's particularly gross. Oh.
Yeah, I don't, you know, when people like ask you how much money you do something for, it's like that'd take quite a bit, I think. That's pretty nasty.
But I've never thought, like, it's gross to lick a handrail like that. I never thought of the taste.
That's particularly
gross.
What about an escalator, like, handle?
It's just a moving bad thing.
Moving bad thing?
Yeah.
The title of my memoirs.
Matt Lawrence is here. Handrail licker.
No.
Handrail taster, actually.
Taste tester.
Yeah. He has a YouTube channel where he tests the tastes of handrails across the country from sea to sea to sea.
Actually, evidence suggests you're the one doing that, Ryan, because you're the one that's always sick.
No.
Oh, okay.
Tim Spence is also with us.
Yes, I'm also here.
How you doing, Tim?
I am not sick, so I take that as a win.
When's the last time you've been sick?
Like really sick?
Just like a cold or whatever?
Yeah, like a cold or a flu or whatever. I think was last... I guess it would have been when I got COVID. But before that, I got a pretty good track record. I've been not sick for like a couple of years. I used to get sick every fall, and I haven't gotten that sick per that schedule in a number of years. So until a pandemic, I was doing great.
You know what's kind of nice during the pandemic was not being sick for like 2 years straight, like just not getting anything, you know?
Now all our immune systems are compromised.
Well, me and Matt had a big old discussion about that now. Neither of us are experts, but we don't know what's going on.
I certainly am not an expert.
I don't know. I think you got a PhD.
You just think? That's good. You're the recruiter for a company and like, I think he's got a PhD. Should be all right.
All right, Matt, you've revamped our fun facts section.
Yeah.
No longer are we going to have bad fun facts, is what you told me.
Well, hopefully.
Ouch.
So tell us.
It's like a direct attack against Ryan, but okay.
Tell us what your fun facts are.
It's a direct attack against like the random lists we were finding.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, do we have an intro for me? Like facts with Matt.
Facts with Matt. Here we go.
No, we don't have that.
We don't have that. Okay.
No.
That's fine.
Not
so I'm going to open up my Adriano OneNote, as I call OneNote now, just because Adriano loves OneNote so much. And this first one, and I have a second one lined up.
In case this one's horrible?
No. I have a second one lined up. I haven't been researched. This is for the next episode.
You didn't do
anyway,
your research?
The first one here is about Xbox's name. So we all know that the Xbox is, you know, related to the DirectX, the Direct Xbox, if you will.
Everyone knows that.
The Xbox, well, we all, I'm pretty sure, knew that. But anyway, the Xbox was basically designed at first to be a box that would run a native version of DirectX. And when they were, you know, finally deciding to build this thing in the early, early days, they're like, all right, we need a code name for this thing. And so it was, since it was a DirectX box in the living room, they would be, that was their original name, DirectX box. And it was really clunky to say in the office every time someone brought it up. So eventually they just said, all right, that's it. We're going to whittle this down. It's just going to be called Xbox. Now, the thing about code names is that usually code names are just that, code names, and they eventually get shed and taken away. And at the time, Microsoft was really all about, you know, corporate stuff, Office, Windows. That was their bread and butter. They had a small gaming division. They made things like Flight Simulator, Microsoft Golf, those type of things. Age of Empires was a big thing, for example. And so they wanted a name that wouldn't evoke Microsoft's corporate image, like Xbox might, right? You wouldn't be like, this is like Office Xbox or Office X or something like that. That's not what you would do. So they started out trying to get the people that named the parts of Windows to, you know, kind of submit some names. And they got a whole bunch of name submissions. And there's hundreds of names in here. Now, this is a short list that I'm just going to run through because the names get more ridiculous by the end of the fun fact. So hundreds of names were submitted by the company. Some of these include Frixion, Cyclips, Norbo,
wow,
Infinity, spelt -D, Shock Factor. Imagine just being what are you playing on? I'm on Shock Factor. It's stupid.
That sounds very much of the time, though, almost. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Fireplug, Vibe with a Y instead of an I.
Classic.
This one fucking killed me. Xantra, spelt the same way as the blood pressure medication of the same name Xantra.
Oh, the hell?
Velvet, just Velvet, and
okay.
Zimulate with a Z or a Z.
Like simulate, but Z?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So those were, so they said, okay, you know, the Xbox team's like, we don't want those things. Okay. And so they were really struggling to replace the name Xbox. But because, again, it's a code name, they're like, we still want to replace this thing. So the father of Xbox, the Xbox founder and creator, Seamus Blackley, he did an interview with a website, and he was talking to them about how eventually they decided, meaning Microsoft decided to hire a branding company or branding companies to come in and say, okay, you know, give us like some good names. We can't come up with any internally. And Seamus Blackley says, quote, these branding companies came in and gave these absolutely appalling, just fucking appalling treatments. Oh. None of the names were any good. And I have some to share with you. And for some reason, they're all acronyms. So there's a whole big list of them, but I took five of them. The first one is MAX. And again, these are all acronyms, which stands for Microsoft Action Experience.
Wow.
Okay.
The other one's called TAC, or TAC, which is the Total Action Center. And with this name, disc/games could be called TAX.
Wow.
The next one.
Okay.
VIC, V-I-C, Virtual Interactive Center. With the same name as TAC, or in the same vein as TAC, the discs or the games could be called VICs. Stupid.
Yep. Isn't VIC already a computer?
The VIC 20 was, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is an acronym. Remember,
this is
not VIC like that. Although I don't know whether that other VIC is an acronym as well. This is the Virtual Interactive Center, Ryan.
No, I know, but if you still can't just have another computer that's called VIC.
But well, anyway, they have this other one here, OM, which stands for Odyssey of the Mind.
Oh my God.
OM.
Oh my God.
And the final one I have here, and there's a whole big collection of them, is XON, which is Experience Optimized Network. So needless to say, they kept trying this over and over again.
These were names for the console?
Yes, that's right.
Wow.
This is from a branding company or companies.
I think this is literally like a shotgun approach, or like throwing everything against the wall and hoping something good comes out of it.
Well, here's like XON could have worked, because they could have called it like Exxon, which sounds like it could be like a console or whatever. But Exxon is also a like gas company.
Yeah.
So
putting the gas down on games. That's not bad.
Full gas, no brakes. Like,
well, the thing is here is that. I'm glad it's called Xbox, but what's hilarious is like these names, like specifically the acronym names, sound like something you'd get from an AI. So it absolutely is a shotgun blast. It's just sort of them going like, okay, everybody, you know, research Microsoft, research the market, then also research games and come up with something, which is why like Microsoft Action Experience is not that crazy. Cause I mean, X sounds like a gamer thing, but in the same breath, there was DirectX already, so
now, you
know, it's not totally ridiculous.
I don't actually know if Xbox was a good name at the time. So me and my friends have talked about this. You know, there's cool band names, but is the name cool, or did the band make the name cool? For example, The Doors. Is that a cool band name? Or if they never existed, would that be dumb? But it's just the band is so awesome.
The Doors
became a cool band name.
Right, yeah.
I wonder if Xbox at the time was seen as stupid, but then it became a popular console with the 360, and then everyone's like, okay, Xbox is now a household name, you know.
Yeah. The Wii.
Yeah, that was ridiculed
the Wii
at the time.
Ridiculous, yeah.
That was ridiculed, yeah.
Yeah. Leonard
iPad
Skinner
was ridiculed.
That's
Leonard Skinner, yeah.
What were people thinking about that? Everyone loves Leonard Skinner.
It's got to be the content makes the name.
Yeah, I think
there
so.
Certainly are some good names, but I feel like sometimes if the name is good, the people don't live up to it, and it becomes a bit of a
but their acronym thing isn't too far off base if you think about the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Yeah,
that's kind of ridiculous, but it became a classic.
When PlayStation was like, you know, kicking around, and like that was called the PS1 at the time, So the acronym, you know, kind of stuck. And I think there's even like a miniature.
Did they call it the PS1 or did they just call it the PlayStation?
No, they call it the PlayStation, which again is just a very straightforward literal name.
A PlayStation station you play at.
Action experience. Like it's the same. It's the same thing.
Well, like isn't there a slim version that literally is branded and it's called PS1, but it's
the last model of it. It's PS and then ONE. Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
But that is my weekly fun fact. And if you want me to tease the next episode.
Sure.
The next episode is, and I have to dig up some stuff because I heard about this, but I have to like go and find it. It's about Mercenaries 2 and a gas station. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Wow. Okay.
There was a promo or something, right? I feel like that sounds familiar to me.
Yeah. It's about that promo before. It getting way the hell out of hand.
Ooh, I can't wait. I can't wait for next week. Oh, yep. My God.
All right. Thanks for that, Matt. That was awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Let's hop into our stories for the week. Sony. Now, I kind of feel like we're a bit of a broken record over here, but these are just kind of the news that's going around. We've often talked about, you know, next gen consoles and PS5 Pros and stuff, but we have another rumor here coming out. Sony's PS5 Pro is up to 3 times faster and may arrive holiday 2024. That is this year, folks. So this is from IGN here, but apparently Sony's own first party. Oh, no, this is not IGN. I think this is from The Verge. Sorry. That is incorrect.
Wait, you're just a huge fan of IGN and just have to give them the credit for it? Come on now, bud.
No, I'm correcting myself here.
I know.
So Sony's own first-party studios have reportedly been testing PS5 Pro dev kits for months now. Sony's reportedly working on a PlayStation 5 Pro model that may well include a far more powerful GPU that's up to 3 times faster than the existing PS5 models. YouTuber Moore's Law is Dead claims to have gotten access to a technical overview document for the PS5 Pro, codenamed Trinity, which is an odd thing to codename it.
As in the Matrix?
The Trinity test, but the Trinity test with the first nuke.
Oh.
So, or maybe this is so powerful, it's like it's nuclear powered.
Whoa.
And now,
power your own house off it.
Yeah. And now Tom Henderson at Insider Gaming reports that the leaked specifications are accurate and the console is currently set to release during holiday 2024 period. Screenshots from the technical documents include the mention of 67 teraflops of 16-bit floating point calculations, which works out to around 33.5 teraflops of single precision compute. That reportedly works out to a 45% rendering performance improvement over the PS5. The existing PS5 is a 10.28 teraflop console. So tripling that would be a significant performance increase on the GPU side alone. Now, I think we've kind of talked about this in the past, maybe not. I don't remember, but teraflops, like comparing teraflops is not always one-to-one comparison with performance. So just keep that in mind. The documents, which were reportedly posted to Sony's own developer portal, also mentioned PlayStation's spectral super resolution, PSSR. This is rumored to use PlayStation machine learning for image upscaling that's similar to NVIDIA's DLSS or AMD's FSR. This may well include upscaling to 8K resolutions in future versions and will help improve ray tracing performance on this rumored PS5 Pro hardware. So, given this, what do you guys think about this potential PS5 Pro?
Tim's a huge fan, and he's going to buy it.
It feels to me like it's too early for a Pro, and yet it's also probably the right time, like based on the timeline of other hardware in the past. But at the same time, like, is there enough reason to do it yet, aside from just money?
Well, I mentioned this because I think you shared this story or something similar, Ryan. With Adriano and I earlier in the week. And I was saying how this generation, like, you're right, Tim, like, timing wise in terms of like a calendar year, makes sense, but it just doesn't feel like this gen is complete. Most of the games on my Xbox, for example, are Xbox 360 games or Xbox One games. And honestly, like, that's not me trying to like necessarily go back and play retro games either. Like, I'm still playing some of these old games multiplayer. The same goes with my PS5. I can't really think of the last time I ran out to go buy a PS5 game.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm buying older games because they're on sale, but not because, you know, I'm trying to be cheap or anything like that or trying to save. I haven't seen anything personally that has, like, really impressed me to the point of me wanting to purchase a PS5 game. So maybe the gen is complete for somebody else And they think that it's, you know, kind of up to where it would be with, you know, the 360 generation or, you know, whatever else, whatever generation we compare it to, PS4, whatever. But I don't know, to me, it just seems like it's incomplete. Partially, though, I think it's because of the amount of support that the PlayStation 4, for example, has had. The PS4 is, you know, still valid. We still have a friend or two that join our party. They're still able to play a lot of different games with us. Having a PS4 is still, let's say, technically relevant, which feels weird. And like Aaron and I have talked this out, and we talked about it on this show too, where it feels as though that attachment to the previous generation, and yes, I understand it's due to the install base, but it's also due to the fact, but it's also holding back the potential of the PS5. Like, devs aren't going to push the PS5 to the absolute limit and try to then make games run well on there when they have the option of just being like, okay, you know, this game has to be on PS4. It has to be on PS5. So we have to basically develop for the weakest link, which is the PS4. And then we can kind of, you know, upscale it a bit or add some ray tracing in the engine's settings for the PS5 version.
I think we oftentimes view this as like, as if you're being forced to upgrade to it, or as if because there needs to be a need for it when it can just exist as a option.
That's fair.
Right. Because I'm always excited for new tech. And obviously, the vast majority of PS4 buyers did not buy the PS4 Pro. Right. But it was there for people who are crazy like me, who just want, you know, something a little faster. And one of my gripes with both last gen and this gen, and I'm not really sure the PS4 Pro actually fixed this or not, but you always have an option now in console games on PS5 to choose between frame rate and graphic fidelity. And it's like, why do I have to make that choice? Why do I have to trade one for the other? So the PS5 Pro just was like, here you have a 4K image at 60 FPS. That's worth it to me, you know, for me personally. Now, I have the luxury of being able to afford it, I kind of like that idea. So I don't know. I do see the point you're making, though, Matt, that, yeah, it's like most games aren't really, I don't think, pushing the PS5 to the limit yet. But we'll see.
That's what I was going to ask you, is like, what game would you, you know, want both from? Because in addition to wanting both, I assume the dev is going to have to put out a patch that runs the game in both performance and fidelity mode or something like that, unless there's something it can fall back on. You know how there was like the PS4 Pro mode or whatever, and if a game didn't have a PS4 Pro bit patch in it that like took advantage, there was no PS4 Pro patch, and the PS4 Pro could, you know, boost the loading times and like make things a little better despite the game not being, you know, optimized for it.
I think we used that on that horror game that we put on the channel. That one you didn't like.
PT?
No.
Outlast?
No. I think it was made by the guy who made Resident Evil.
PT?
No.
Or, sorry, Resident Evil.
Until Dawn?
No. Remember, it was so long. It was a super long game. Adriana was playing it.
Oh, God. Evil Within?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
We used the PS4 Pro boost mode to get the frame rate up on that a bit.
Holy
it
Christ.
It was chunky about, in some areas.
Well, chunky. Yeah, chunky and too damn long is what it was. Holy crap.
I do want to talk about this 3x the performance. That seems like a bigger jump to me than the PS4 Pro was. Now, I don't know the numbers from back then, but like that almost sounds like a new console generation to me. Now, it might very well be a Pro, but what do you guys think about 3x the graphical performance, potentially?
I wonder if we're at the point now where like, we're going to start seeing exponential growth like that just because of the nature of technology, right? Like, mm-hmm. 3x the performance is going to become a normal jump. And this is just the beginning of it kind of thing.
Is this a move actually to drive another nail into the coffin of Xbox's sales? The reason why I ask that is because the Xbox Series S is not going to be able to keep up with something that's 3x the performance of the PS5, let alone the PS5 proper anyway. And Xbox seems dedicated to the Xbox Series S.
As they should be, though, because they're selling it as a brand new next generation console.
Oh, no, as they should be. But then PlayStation can advertise that they have the most high fidelity and blah, blah, blah.
It's a bit of a ball and chain for them that I think they didn't expect these kind of consequences. A lot of developers we've heard reportedly are angry that they have to support the Series S.
limited Baldur's Gate for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
That whole argument, though, is kind of like, to me, it's iffy just because, I mean, they support low end PCs with like a, you know, a fidelity, lower resolutions, lower textures, all the different fidelity settings you have on a PC. I mean, hell, I was running Baldur's Gate, not well, but I was running Baldur's Gate on a 12-year-old tower. I mean, well, it didn't have upgraded drivers.
Like, we're not game devs, though, but I'm not sure what the process is for optimizing for different consoles and PC.
That's fair, you know, yeah.
It might be a different team that is actually working on the PC version than the ones working on the console version.
And what's considered acceptable on PC is very different from what's acceptable on console.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
But what I find interesting is we heard during that business update from Xbox that they had the most powerful console update ever coming out, right? And maybe that is an Xbox Series X Pro or variant version that's going to compete with this. They probably know what each other are working on, you know, or have an idea. So this could all be in line with that, right?
Well, could Xbox not necessarily scuttle the Series S? I don't think they should do that. But do you see them ever handing off the
Series?
They
should and shouldn't.
Well, like, do you ever see them handing off the Series S to game streaming? Because I know that Xbox has been experimenting with game streaming. So obviously with Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, you do get game streaming. But it doesn't include the entire Xbox library. It only includes the Xbox Game Pass library and only the majority of it. I don't think it's everything. I don't think it's all encompassing. But they have been experimenting with, you know, if you own something just from the Xbox store, that you could stream it. I don't know if you need Xbox, you know, Game Pass Ultimate for that or what, but it is still sort of like a logistical thing that they're testing. And Outriders is actually one of those things where it left Game Pass, but at my last check, you could still stream it if you owned it.
Mm-hmm.
So with all that being said, I'm curious whether or not they would just eventually say, okay, the Series S is, you know, going to be supported by streaming and it'll get, you know, like most of the games will probably still work, but the most high fidelity ones, those ones you'll have to stream. And then it'll be the Xbox Series X and the Xbox Series X Pro that are the consoles that run things like on board.
I don't know. Cause you expect a certain life expectancy, I guess, of your console when you buy it. You know, it would be kind of bad for them just to be like, oh, sorry, you're not getting any new releases. You're just going to have to stream them, you know?
Yeah, it wouldn't be great for sure.
I think they kind of almost shot themselves in the foot. Now, I don't know how much it's hurting them or not. It may not be, but and I'm curious what the numbers are. You know, what's sales wise Series S to X? Is the S outselling the X by like a 3-to-1 or something or 2-to-1? I don't know, because that would be a problem, because then you have even more of your smaller player base compared to Sony on a inferior console. You know, it makes harder to make those decisions.
I wonder how much that, you know, the casual gamer, like if you're a casual gamer or a budget centric gamer, you're willing to make certain sacrifices, right?
Yeah.
Like the casual gamer may not even be aware or care about the most high fidelity. Someone's on a budget would know like, oh, I'm using, you know, some older tech, or I'm using sort of like a mid-range phone or whatever, or an Xbox Series S over an X, right? Like they've made the decision to be budget conscious and that's what they've chosen. So I guess the question at that point is, you know, if this PS5 Pro is sort of supposed to be a jab at Xbox, does it really matter? Because if Xbox is dominating at that mid to low range in terms of price point console, if they're dominating at that range, I mean, these people, like when you play on a Series S, you're not getting a totally garbage picture. You're not getting an Xbox, you know, 360s graphics. Far from it. You're getting something that's way better than that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is a bit of like that. How much does the service matter? A little bit too, right? Because I'm sure that the people who are budget conscious are also probably going to have Xbox Game Pass, because if you are a person that churns through games, that is hands down the best way, unless you really hand pick the games you purchase. It is hands down the best way, budget friendly way to get through games. To get new games, and the best way to play multiplayer games, because if everyone has Game Pass, then you all have it. You don't have to pay for it. Yada yada, right? Like those points have been beaten to death.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is Xbox going to potentially become like the Android, if you will, the Android to Apple, where PS5 is going to be sort of the designer game brand, because it kind of seems to be taking on that appeal anyway. And Microsoft sort of like, not necessarily the scrappy one, but Microsoft has, you know, the high end Samsung phone, if you will, of Android, which is the Xbox Series X. But then they also have like the Motorola, which is a solid but mid to low budget console, which is the Series S. And both Android and Apple are doing fine.
Yeah, both can exist for sure. And I think it was Bill Gates who said that you could always, the market can support two platforms. Now, obviously, there's a Nintendo, but I mean, they don't really ever talk about them as a competitor in the same way, right?
Yeah.
We've talked about that a lot, too, is that, like, I don't know, they just seem like in a land of their own. They don't even care, you know, that they don't have Call of Duties and crap. Like, you know what I mean? It's just irrelevant to them, it seems. Here's a question. Price. What would the price be? Now, we're in Canada. The PS5 Slim is $579. And with the disc drive, $649, which raises another question. Will this pro version even have a disc drive?
Maybe a modular one.
Oh, do the same thing?
That's interesting.
Now, here's what's weird about that is that you can buy that modular one separately, right? And stick it onto your Slim version. Are they going to have a different model of disc drive for the pro? You know what
Probably
I mean?
Not.
Or is it going to attach on somehow?
Would it need to support? It could just do like a cable, right?
I don't know if it allows that. I think it has to be. Doesn't it need the internet to even like sync up and all that crap?
Yeah, because I don't know, but I can't remember that, but it doesn't, it's not like the, I mean, I'm dating myself. It's not like the HD DVD external drive of the 360 where they plugged it into, I believe it was the USB port. It actually like connects to the PS5 Slim to some extent, right? Like it like physically like
you snap it in
to it.
And then whatever plugs it needs to plug in, get plugged in when you snap it in.
Well, you know what? Honestly, like I could see it being either the same thing and maybe the PS5 Pro would come with it, or it would be something as simple as it needs a different housing and it would be just like you click off the housing, you click it on.
I'm going to make a prediction. No disc drive.
Maybe.
As for price, I mean, if we're going off Canadian price here, I'm going to say $750 to $800.
I was going to say $799.
$800.
Yeah.
And it will probably come out $900, which is a lot of money.
Well, you know what, though? Like, I was talking to a buddy about this. Like, yeah, and I'm not saying it's like not that much money, but for the amount of time you get out of these consoles, I mean, they are still so cheap in comparison to so many other hobbies out there. Mm-hmm. Imagine having a boat or being a car guy or, you know, anything like that. That is so much money.
Yeah.
And if you really think about, I guess, like the rent in Canada is like, what, $2,500 to $3,000? Realistically speaking, like you can buy all three consoles, which would include the Switch, for less than a month's rent and have them for over 10 years if the generations stay the same and still be relevant and still have games to play that come out regularly. That's a pretty good value for an entertainment device. Because the 360, I'm pretty sure you can still do, or maybe it's recently been decommissioned, but the 360, I'm pretty sure you could still do like Netflix and stuff like that. That's the Xbox 360. Like that's a freaking long time ago. That's only the second Xbox.
Yeah. I was watching some like anniversary video on the PlayStation. I can't remember which one it was with those PS1 or PS2. But all Sony did when they came out to like announce it, they said like just one sentence or even just one, I guess,
one number.
And it was like $199, and then they walked off stage and everyone went nuts, you know, cuz they undercut whoever their competitor was at the time, Sega CD or whatever it was. And that was just like a huge moment. I was wondering about this, if I was in charge of a business, whether I'd get crucified for this or not. But let's say I ran Xbox, right? And we wanted to beat PlayStation to come the next console generation. I would just be like, our next gen console generation that's five times as powerful as the Series X is $199. You know what I mean? Just eat it. Just eat that massive cost to win that generation. Because then it's easier to hold on to them moving forward, right? But how does Xbox claw its way back after PlayStation won the last two generations? You know,
I think the shareholders wouldn't let you.
Oh yeah, no, it would be horrible.
You know,
but it's like that would be an awesome risk I would love to take.
Is price that big of a driving factor when the PlayStation seems to be getting that sort of designer status?
Maybe it's too late now, but I think for sure if you made a console that was equally as powerful and equally as polished and had, you know, all the major kind of games you want to play on it. And you just came in with a super low price, you know, they already make most of their money from selling software anyway. You know, it's rare to actually make money off your console. So why not just, you know, bite a bigger bullet, lose a little more money, you know, because if it does end up working, if you do end up selling millions of more consoles, that means you're selling millions of more software on those consoles.
I was going to say, you got to have something to sell, though. And like, people look at Xbox and they go, like, what's exclusive to Xbox?
That's a problem now, yeah.
Like, that's a huge problem.
The, like, the one question, too, is, like, they, I don't know if it's still available, but the Xbox had that, you know, you sort of pay for your console over time. It's like console as a service.
Oh,
you
yeah.
You pay more and you get, you know, sort of a bundle. You get, you know, Xbox Game Pass. You get the Xbox Series S, I think it was. And I don't know if it's zero down or 50 down or whatever it was. But then, you know, you pay this sort of inflated fee for a certain amount of period. You pay off your Xbox and then you just, you know, I guess it's optional, but you can continue to pay for Xbox Game Pass afterwards. And that is like a very low barrier to entry for many people. But yet I don't see anyone really doing that. Like I don't know of anyone out of a, I mean, admittedly a small sample size, but I don't know of anyone that has done that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I wonder if this, they're talking about 8K with the upscaling kind of stuff. I wonder if that will herald in the new 8K future. Obviously no one really has 8K TVs. They're crazy expensive. But maybe this will push it forward a little bit, at least, because they're obviously not going to sell as many of these as PS5s. But anyway.
Good question. I wonder what drives like screen sales more, like broadcasts and streaming quality or like gaming?
Well, broadcasts aren't necessarily at 4K yet, right?
No.
How many channels are actually broadcasting in 4K?
I wouldn't know. I haven't paid for a cable package ever in my life.
Well, maybe that would be a difference. If Netflix or whoever offers a 8K package, would people do that? It's that weird chicken and egg thing, because you need the TV to subscribe to the 8K package, you know?
But you need to have the 8K package.
To get the TV, yeah. And whether you need 8K or not is another question. 4K, I'm always for, you know, doing the next better technological step, but 4K is pretty sharp, pretty damn sharp.
I'm still cool with my 1080p.
That's crazy.
These are my 1080p monitors forever.
Getting those frames, though.
Hell yeah.
All right, let's move on to our next story. Aspyr makes Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection statement after crashing to overwhelmingly negative reviews. Said it's working on it, doesn't apologize or explain why it needs 62.87 gigabytes on your disk of your disk space. First of all, that's a ridiculous headline, PC Gamer. you might want to shorten that up and make it a little less weird. I want to start with this, though. 62.87 gigabytes. What is that? These are PS2 games.
Textures?
The 4K textures, like...
Yeah.
I don't even know how many times it quadrupled the size. But anyway, with the Steam user reviews now comfortably at overwhelmingly negative, it's fair to say that the Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection has been a disaster. Pilloried by players as probably one of the most worst launches of all time within hours of release. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah.
That sounds a little bit hyperbolic.
Yeah. The Witcher 3?
The collection has been a black eye for Aspyr after last month's well-regarded Tomb Raider remasters. In the wake of all that, the company has released a stunningly brief statement on where it plans to go from there, thanking the Battlefront community for its overwhelming support and feedback for the Classic Collection. Aspyr cops to the fact that it experienced critical errors with our network infrastructure that caused high ping, matchmaking errors, crashes, and servers not appearing in the browser. Now, Matt, you said something about like they only had like a few servers.
That's all that was showing up in the browser. Yeah, I heard that there was only two servers that were appearing in the first couple of hours, and then more started to appear hours later.
They didn't pre-launch all the servers before launching the game?
It sounds like it was a bug, though. Like okay. I think Matt, you insinuated that they had only purchased space for like two servers.
That's what people were saying, but I was watching it kind of unfold live. So I haven't updated myself since like watching people complain. And it was social media complaints too, to be clear.
The statement from Aspyr says that servers were not appearing in the browser.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have been there, but there might have been some glitch that made them not appear.
Fair enough.
Which would be an issue.
Yeah.
But I'm always surprised by this. I thought we were kind of past the point where like people understood how online games work now and that you wouldn't see as many of these server crashes on launches.
They should have said they got DDoSed.
I don't want them to lie.
No, just straight up lie.
It might have been a DDoS.
I think a lot of this stuff has to do with, like, I'm not a game developer, but having seen like web apps get made and stuff like that, we're starting to pile more and more areas of expertise onto a single person because there's tools to fill in for the lack of mastering a particular skill. So it means that a lot of people are becoming jacks of, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. And whereas that's great for, you know, diversifying your skill set and you being able to help in various different teams and various areas of your own team, or even assisting other teams in troubleshooting by you being able to talk the talk with them. It's a lot to fall on, you know, a singular person or even a couple of people. And like, you'd be surprised, again, I'm not in game development, but you'd be surprised how much like critical infrastructure online is supported by one or two people. Wow. You know, like really, like literally one or two people. So, and that's with deadlines and, you know, people freaking out about, you know, you got to get this out now and blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, a lot of stuff is taped together and I'm wondering whether gaming is starting to become that, where it's just sort of like throw it together, like, because there's a lot of tooling. If you think about it with, I think it's called like Play Labs or something from Azure, like Microsoft Azure. And also, I forget exactly what it's called now, but there's like gaming and matchmaking services by these big cloud computing things like AWS and Azure, which I've already mentioned, that allow you to sort of like quickly plug in and whatever. Because if you think about it, I mean, if millions of people are playing a game that's an indie game, that indie studio doesn't have 1,000 people supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. An indie studio might have 10 people and not all of them are server guys, right? There might be one server person. So this just might be, again, like this could be ill preparation or whatever. Like, I don't know, again, not a game developer, but this very well could be a side effect of hurry up and get this done real quick. Okay, quickly. All right, we'll just test it with a couple servers in the office. All right, cool. Okay, ship it. Go. Oh, now it's all broken. Shit. Well, I'm not a master of this, so it's going to take a while for me to fix. And then it becomes a whole rigmarole.
Yeah, it just reminds me of, like, my father-in-law works in IT security, and, like, he has said multiple times, like, you would be flabbergasted to know the amount of, like, personal information, you know, like information for banks or whatever, all this stuff that's in databases that is behind one firewall.
One mistake away, like one failure, one mistake, one glitch away. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, they've got fail safes, but if that firewall fails, it's all over.
Our entire digital society is a house of cards.
Yes.
Cause it's built quick. It's not built for, like, if you even hint at, you know, hey, let's take our time and do this properly, it's like, why would we do that?
And time is money, friend.
You almost look like an idiot in meetings if you say stuff like that sometimes. It's always go faster, you know, do it cheaper, do it better, Papa John's. Like, it's always that.
Yeah, they always say Papa John's in the meeting. Yeah.
I imagine too that like, you know, managing these servers is a bit of a, you need skill to do it and like knowledge on how to do it. You can't just get anyone to work on your servers. They have to know what they're doing, right?
Well, so this is a kind of a scary thing, but like I said, I work in web development, and I've mentioned to other web developers, because I come from the IT field originally, I've mentioned networking, and they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, we're using networking to connect to the website, to host the website. What do you mean? And they only know the website game from the aspect of their tools that, you know, make a site go live or make a site go down or make a site go up or update it. They don't understand that there's like network, like there's switches and routers and all that stuff to go. They don't know. Many people do not know what networking is.
Wow.
Outside of their home networking.
Yeah. I guess this too wasn't a big high profile game, and even high profile games have server issues, but this was a little more, you know, off the beaten path kind of game. So they probably weren't expecting too much really, and then just got overwhelmed. And I still do want to get it. And did you pre-order it, Matt?
I did, but I haven't booted up my PlayStation since.
Yeah. So I do want to kind of get back and play those games and see how they run and how they look and stuff. So, all right. I don't know if this game had server issues, because there might not have been enough people.
No.
Caused some server issues, but WB Games says it plans to double down on live service despite Suicide Squad failing to meet expectations. Excuse me. It's from IGN. Warner Bros. Discovery CEO and president of streaming and games, JB Peretti, spoke about the company's strategy during a recent Morgan Stanley event. He acknowledges the success of projects like the single-player Hogwarts Legacy, which managed to be last year's best-selling game in the U.S., but says the business of AAA console releases can be volatile. Quote, that's a great business when you have a hit like Hogwarts Legacy. It makes the year look amazing. Unfortunately, we also have disappointments. We just released Suicide Squad this quarter, which was not as strong. It just makes it very volatile. End quote. He explained that Warner Bros. Is looking at its four major franchises, Mortal Kombat, Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, and DC, and is hoping to expand in the mobile and multi-platform free-to-play space. It will take some time for Warner Bros. Efforts to come to fruition, with Perrette estimating we'll see the impact between 2025 and 2027. He does say, though, that the company will release more mobile free-to-play games later this year. So let's just start talking about this first part here. He says that AAA console releases can be volatile. I guess he's speaking in general, not just about single-player games, but he's talking about in context of Hogwarts Legacy being a big success. But so if he's just saying single-player games is volatile, I feel like so is games as a service, and potentially more so, right?
I feel like the most volatile market, or like genre, I guess, yeah, is like games as a service, but also like multiplayer.
Yeah.
Like single player, I would imagine to be the most stable, because it's a much more like easily curated experience at the end of the day. Whereas like when a game is inherently multiplayer, even if it wasn't like designed as the core feature of the game, you add multiplayer to a game, you don't know what's going to happen with it as a product.
I feel like I can think of more live service games that have failed than big, massive AAA games that have failed.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only one I can think of is that that Square Enix one, Matt. Forspoken.
Oh, like, right. I was thinking Marvel's Avengers.
But that's a games as a service.
Yeah.
I'm saying a failure of a massive single player game.
Right, right.
The thing
with a single player game is it doesn't have that whole chicken and egg situation like we described earlier, almost, where like in order to bring players in, the game has to be good. But in order for the game to be good, you have to have players playing it so they can complain and then the developers can fix it. Or like you have to have players there to convince the suits to allow for the budget to be spent on it and improving the game. But with a single player game, that exists a little bit, but you also like have more free reign on like, okay, we can make the, like, we can make a really cool mode for single player that makes your character like a god, but who cares if that seems unfair because it's a single player game, it's not a multiplayer game type thing. Like that just seems to be more options there, and you don't have to worry about the community being affected by it and like, oh no, the players are going to progress too fast. Like that is a concern, but it's less of a concern in a single player game, I would imagine.
Yeah. His comments seem extra kind of goofy when Suicide Squad, which took them, you know, 10 years to make or whatever, and it probably cost a buttload of money, and it was a big flop. And then you also had not Sea of Thieves. I always want to say Sea of Thieves.
Skull and Bones.
Another game that took like 15 years to come out, probably cost a ton of money. They called it a quadruple A game and so ended up being a failure.
The balls to call it a quadruple A game. Yeah. Man.
And it ended up being a failure, as far as we know, I guess. It's already, what did you say, Matt, 40% off, 35% off? Something like that?
I think it was 40% off on Xbox. Don't quote me, though.
So it's like those were two massive games as a service games that just flopped entirely. And when you look at the single player games on the best selling lists for last year, 2023, it's like Jedi Survivor, Hogwarts Legacy, Tears of the Kingdom. Like there's some really good single player games that sold super well then.
Bangers.
But I think it's just too lucrative. There must be something so enticing about having a Fortnite like game that just keeps rolling in dough. Right,
that's it right there. There's something that's enticing. It's really
chasing,
obvious. It's
the money. Chasing it, even though it's not always logical. I feel,
but it's like gambling. You know, it's putting enough money out that eventually they'll hit the jackpot.
Yeah, I just feel like that's harder to do.
Yeah, it's astronomically worse odds.
I think the big problem too is that a lot of these games, I don't mean to sound rude, but you know, they take 7 or 8 years. And like, I don't know how they take that long. I'm not a game dev, but, you know, having what I call a lockpicking game on your Skull and Bones ship to cut down trees and to open doors and those type of things is so like low hanging fruit, I want to say, for content. And like every quest in these games, most of the time are like super shallow. Like, oh, my dog got lost. See if you can find him. Thanks for finding my dog. Next season. My dog got lost again. Can you help? You know, it's like, holy fuck. It's like the Assassin's Creed, the open world ones, like Odyssey and Origins. It's, or the, I guess, RPG ones. It's like those side quests. Like, I hate the side quests in those games because some of them are good, which are, you know, and the good ones are good, but there's so many that are just like, my farm was burned down. It's those damn Templars again. Help me out, please. You know, it's just like, holy Christ. Like, I don't want to talk to you. And I don't want to help your stupid farm because it's stupid. Like, it. So, like, but like, the, it feels like a lot of these games as a service games, they just sort of make up a story loosely and then they go like, well, protect that point. They just take the gameplay tropes of today and go, protect that point, you know, cover your ally, keep that NPC alive. And there's no sort of innovation involved at all, which is really unfortunate. Something like The Division, which is kind of like a silent, in the grand scheme, games as a service game that is successful, I think is successful because the game is super fun. You actually feel like you're progressing. The activities, like there's a ton of activities to do now. And the missions actually do feel like, you know, missions. They're not as in depth as say like a COD mission where it's single player and they can have more cinematic moments. But it feels like, you know, it's as close to like a COD mission, which is like an action pack, you know, narrative driven mission that you can get in a 4-player multiplayer environment. But this game, Suicide Squad specifically, sounds like it just ended up like Anthem, where it's like, Anthem's like, we have this cool flying mechanic. Go protect that tower. You know, Suicide Squad is kind of the same shit where it's like, we have guns. You can buy guns in the store and crap. You know, it's just, it's too centric around the games as a service. It should be game first and then service it after.
Which sounds obvious, and yet it's not the majority.
No, absolutely.
Because Hogwarts Legacy sold like crazy. And that game easily could have had some store in it.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would buy different robes and different wands and different stuff. You know, it so easily could have been added into that and they didn't do it. It doesn't even have DLC. They didn't even do DLC for it. And it was like the most successful game of 2023. 20 million copies of this game sold. And they didn't do any monetization on it. And it's like, how did you miss that one? You know?
Didn't WB bugger up Shadow War 2? Where they had like Shadow War and they were like, oh, loot boxes are popular. We'll have loot boxes in this game. And they're like, but they're optional. And then they were kind of made fun of and so underused for so long that they just got taken out of the game eventually.
Yeah, something like that, right?
I remember the loot boxes and I remember them being taken away eventually. That
vaguely sounds familiar. But what kind of angers me too is Rocksteady was such a beloved single player studio. People loved those Batman games. They were really good. The world building was amazing. You know, the amount of detail they put into those worlds was incredible. The combat was revolutionary at the time and super fun and addictive. And it's like, let's take this beloved single player studio, force them to make a games as a service instead of getting some other studio that already knows how to make games as a service.
And probably has a lot more passion for doing it.
Yeah. Rocksteady doesn't know how to make a games as a service. Crystal Dynamics doesn't know how to make a games as a service, you know. And it's just like, you can't pump all this money into it and hope the IP alone is what sells it. Just because it has Avengers written on it does not mean you're going to make a successful game. And Suicide Squad is not the biggest IP out there either. Like, that's, you know, that's very weird that they chose to do that. But so I just want them. It's like, I'm fine with games as a service. Go make them. But also keep the single player devs single player.
Why is it, too, that these games are so shallow as well and take so long to make? It almost would make sense if they come out in 2 years, they're shallow and they just come out. And again, I'm not a game dev, so I'm not trying to say that the job is easy, but I'm sorry, but having, you know, one or two weapon or enemy varieties in Avengers, like the amount of times we killed the same robots over and over again, the amount of times we go to the same locations, it's like Starfield a bit, right? Where it's like, oh, go kill this eclectic guy, go kill this spacer. And it's like, he's located at Mech Lab, and all Mech Lab are the same.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Like, why isn't there 5 Mech Labs? Like, what the fuck? Like, why the fuck did this take? Why did this game take you so long? Is the tech too hard to manage? Are we trying to rush things out and then we're screwing up too much? Are we conceptualizing wrong? Like, are these games as a service games so around, you know, being algorithmic? Like, we need to be shareable on social. We need everyone to buy this. We need everyone to love this. We want to make sure people take clips and then share it on TikTok and Twitter and everything else. Are these games being strategized to death and they're not being developed to death, if you will, where they're getting developed for like 4 years, but you know, it's 4 years of like quote unquote actual development in engine, but there's like an additional 5 years of everyone fighting over like the name and like how, what color palette do we use and what are people talking about on TikTok and what are our competitors doing? You know, is that where it's getting bogged down? And that's still quote unquote developing the game, right? Not from a technical standpoint, it's not being programmed, but it's being developed. Is that what's happening? Because I just have a hard time seeing like how is it taking so long for some of these games to get made when it's just like we have four activities and they're in 15 spots across our one map? Like, how did this take so long? What happened?
Yeah. A game like Remnant 2 that has so much replayability to it, and it's such a smaller team and project than something like Starfield, and yet the possibilities for replayability are so much more engaging.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny when Helldivers comes out right after Suicide Squad and Skull and Bones too, and Helldivers just takes the internet by storm and just is doing that model right.
Yeah, there's rightfully so.
There's microtransactions in it, like you can buy digital currencies to buy things in the store, but the base battle pass is free, and you can find the currency in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of grind your way up to buying certain things. And look how popular it's been. It's just been crazy.
So. Imagine being able to play the game and getting stuff for it.
Yeah, that's right.
What a concept.
But I fear this will never change because clearly this WB executive got the wrong lesson from 20 million sales of Hogwarts and very few sales of Suicide Squad.
I mean, to be fair, Hogwarts, like Harry Potter is one of the most massive IPs in the world.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean.
But I think what made Hogwarts work is they literally did what like everyone wanted. People just wanted a Hogwarts game where you go to Hogwarts, you explore freely,
run around.
There's a ton of hidden things. It was basically the Arkham Asylum game for Harry Potter, where they had all this detail in it and all these little secrets and, you know, Easter eggs and stuff. And it was just exactly the game people wanted at the right time. So I know that's hard to do, you know, but damn.
Well,
anyway,
what's super interesting too is like if you take a big franchise like Fallout 4 is a big jump from Fallout 3 technologically and whatever. Yes, I know there's criticisms with Bethesda's engine and whatever, but Fallout 4 is almost 10 years ago now. So like Fallout 4 in its own right is old. And at least in my opinion, I thought it ran okay and I enjoyed the game a lot. But then came out Fallout 76. And I know Fallout 76 had, you know, was being worked on a little bit during 4 and whatever, but it came out what, 2 years ish, I think, after 4. And Fallout 76 was criticized to death, you know, major technical problems, I know that, and all that stuff. But if we just take a think, if we just throw that aside for a second and just look at the content was barely there for Fallout 76. Protect this point, talk to this robot, go protect that robot, go get that holotape, you know, that's Fallout 76 in the early days. And yet that's the level of content we're getting out of games that have taken 8 years to make.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm sorry to say this, but if Bethesda of all people can take a very highly controversial and like technically limited, arguably, engine and make it multiplayer to the point where, yeah, it's, you know, wasn't the greatest experience, but make a game that has as much content as your game in, you know, 3 or 4 years, even if it took 6 years, like whatever the full development cycle was of Fallout 76, it came out 2-ish years after 4, you know, and it wasn't Skull and Bones. Like, I think Skull and Bones was Skull and Bones announced before Fallout 4? Probably. Announced before Fallout 4 came out?
It was a long time ago.
Or like it was around when Fallout 4 was announced. It's like, what the fuck have you guys been doing? Like, since then, Bethesda, and again, yes, I know their games aren't perfect, but Bethesda has released Fallout 4 around the time Skull and Bones was announced, around that time. So a couple years span, let's say. Couple years birth there. Fallout 76 and Starfield, and not to mention, you know, id and other companies of theirs have released things, but like a lot of games come out and yet Skull and Bones was still like in development. And then is when it comes out, it's like, yeah, you know, it's super shallow and play this lockpicking game, cut down that tree. Like, what the fuck were you guys like? I don't mean to sound like a dick, but what the fuck were you guys doing all those years? Like, that's crazy.
Well, it's also the same concept as like Duke Nukem Forever, right? It's just there's lots of development issues that arise, and those issues could have arisen for you know, a Bethesda title as well. It's just that, you know, they didn't, and maybe it's the studio, or maybe it was the game itself, or maybe it was a bunch of external factors. Like, it's hard to say, right?
This sounds crazy, but Skull and Bones was announced in 2017.
So 2 years after the release of Fallout 4.
Yeah. That felt like, I thought it was longer than that.
It felt longer than that, yeah.
Reason.
It's been a long 7 years.
But all right, that's our news for the week. Moving on to what we're playing. Matt, what are you playing?
Me?
Yeah, what the hell have you been playing?
So I have completed quite a bit of the American campaign of Call of Duty Roads to Victory on my PSP. I was talking to you, Ryan, though, at one point. I think I was texting you. I was like, if I just sat down and played this thing for like one evening, it would just be over. It would just be done with. But yeah. I just haven't done that. I've just been picking it up, playing it sort of like a mobile game. So I'm almost done the American campaign. And then there's two other campaigns. There's a Canadian and I think British as well. So I don't know if they're longer, shorter, or the same, but we'll see what's up there. So I've been doing that. And then, like, kind of weirdly, I've just been doing like a whole bunch of Starfield. I went and I'm just trying to complete a lot of the factions and sort of experience the actual sort of like quests, the side stuff that I have never really experienced before too much. So I've been doing those. And I mean, the UC mission that you do with, I'm trying to be vague intentionally, with the Terramorphs, I think is very well written. I think it's, you know, probably, I don't know if it's top tier Bethesda, but it's a pretty fun mission. There's a half decent ending to it. There's a fair bit of like, oh, what's going to happen next? You have some like very questionable moral choices to make, and making certain choices will open up more content for you or remove content from you, which is really cool. So, I mean, it's a good quest line, especially for a Bethesda game. I have some, you know, problems with it. I mentioned it before where some of the stuff's a little unbelievable, but it's pretty good. So I'm on to yet another set of missions. I'm getting pretty rich in the game right now. So I'm going to try to make my own ship too, which I've never done. I've only ever modified ships that I've stolen. So my ship's kind of shit because I literally took a passenger cruise liner, like literally for like a vacationing, like for vacationing cruise people, whatever. And I just strapped a bunch of guns to it and put this massive reactor on top of it and just fly that thing around. So it's slow and it sucks. So I'm going to try to make something better, custom. So that's going to be kind of like my next goal. And then I'm going to play around with the outposts and stuff like that. And I'm looking forward to see, there's supposed to be an update coming out where it allows you to decorate your ship. So I'm interested in that because I want the ship to be better. I want the ship to be more sort of crucial to me rather than just being like a fast travel machine for me. But other than that, we've been doing some Remnant. So on stream, we beat, I forget the name of the DLC, that we beat the first DLC of Remnant 2, which is pretty fun. And then Tim and I, the other day, we hopped on, it might have been a session or two, because I think we did a couple over a few weeks, but we've completed all the gear that I need for my build. So I have to upgrade some of my mutators, and there's a set of gloves that I could get just to raise my defense a little bit. But in terms of effects, I have everything I need. And those gloves are the hardest fucking thing to get. I think you and I were talking, Tim. Like, yeah. it's such an event, and it's like, for like a little less weight and a little more armor, it's probably not worth it.
It's some of the stuff in this game is so insane to get because you have to have like a specific role of a world, and which is just like RNG
already, and ridiculous.
And it's like, how would you even know to do this stuff? And then it's like, also you have to be, it has to be done in the same campaign. Then this campaign also has to be this particular role of this world and this particular role of this world. And then you also need to like know what to do because it's not necessarily like inherently straightforward. It's crazy. It's absolutely bonkers that people even figure this stuff out, let alone for it to be a requirement for like a pretty good piece of gear. But again, that just comes back to sort of the like conversation of like how they managed to make the game so replayable.
Well, that's exactly it too, is it's like, you know, I've seen these sort of Lego blocks, if you will, of the game over and over again. But even just sort of like taking a break for like a week or like whatever, and then coming back to it, it still feels fresh because it's like, I don't know what the next portal is going to be. Also, I might be trying to do something different. Like you and I went into Yesha, I believe, and I was like, yo, like put on this necklace in front of this statue. And yeah, the statue opens up and gives you this like forbidden fruit. And you're like, what in the fuck is this? And even that was a bit of a puzzle, you know, to figure out how to use the forbidden fruit. And it's like, how many times have we walked by that statue in Yesha? not knowing that there was a full secret passage underneath it. Like, that's cool as shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, it just makes me wonder, like, the game's been out for a couple months. Yeah, people have found lots of stuff. What are people still going to be figuring out years from now, you know?
Well, especially when, like, as we bought the DLC pass, so it's supposed to include a few DLC packs. Once everything's all combined and then they patch it and stuff, like, how many intertwining things are there going to be, man, now?
Like, between DLCs and stuff, too? Yeah, that's true. Because the DLC, like, the gloves you're talking about was something from the main campaign, but then also from, like, the DLC campaign.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, man, I didn't even really think about that. That's true.
And it's a part. So they're the Crimson Guard, I believe. It's the Crimson Guard gauntlets. They're a red set of gauntlets.
Yeah.
And they're part of like an armor set. Now, I don't know how to get the other pieces of the armor, but I would imagine that they are, you know, I would, just being in the same sets, I would imagine they're pretty convoluted. I don't need them and I'm not supposed to use them, so I haven't looked them up. But like, if you wanted that set, at the very least, you're putting a lot of effort in to get those gauntlets. And then God knows how much effort you're putting in to get the rest of that thing.
I would hope that they're all together. I would hope that after all that work, you'd get a full set of armor, but...
Oh, that's a good question. I don't actually know if that's a good question. You might.
I think you probably just get it all at the same time, but I don't know.
Well, what's crazy about that fight, too, is you fight a certain boss in a certain way or whatever, or like, or lack thereof. Maybe you don't fight him. I'm intentionally being vague for spoilers.
Yeah.
But there's a particular way to attack that boss that I'm talking about that is completely unrelated to the Crimson Guard gauntlets or anything like that. And you get a certain weapon from it. And then you can also do it a different way and get a crown from it. So like, that boss is involved in three, at least that I know of, things. And you have to do it right, or you have to restart, basically.
And then there's some stuff that, too, that's like injectable events into certain dungeons or parts of the game that are like one and dones. Like, if you screw it up, you have to reroll the whole campaign to try again.
And hope that you get that dungeon and hope that you get that event in that dungeon again.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is like... At first, when I heard that, I was like, no, there's no way. Like, there's no way it's that insane. Like, that's literally just asking people, like, to drive people mad. And no, that's what it is. But you know what? The longer that I, like, go with it, the more I kind of love it. So,
well, I kind of wonder, too. Like, I know Apocalypse is, I never played it yet. Apocalypse difficulty. I know that it's, you know, obviously the hardest difficulty. And by that, I've heard it's, like, insanely difficult. And I kind of was thinking to myself, I was like, you know, Remnant kind of felt like the game. Before I started like looking at Apocalypse and started looking at builds, was it kind of felt like the game where I was just supposed to play it through and just keep playing it, you know, whenever I want, and, you know, keep collecting the purple items, you know, keep getting new items, and then slowly sort of chip away at my character. Oh, that's a better item. I'll try that out. Blah, blah, blah. But like, if you were to do that sort of, you know, meandering way to go through it, where you're missing things over and over again, like you might go into the asylum, not know you can go into this door, and you miss this necklace. That would be super good for you to build over and over again because you have no idea you can go in there. It's like the amount of times you would go through it to then accidentally stumble upon it one day to get it. It would take you forever to earn, quote unquote, enough gear to get to Apocalypse. Like, I can't even imagine how many hours you would have to do without guides to figure this stuff out. Like, it's crazy. But
can't wait to see more DLC.
Yeah, actually, it should be pretty good. But that has been my week.
Tim?
Been playing a lot of Remnant in my own time, just like trying to gear grind as well. But I've been playing Red Dead Redemption 2 again on stream for the first time in 3 years. And I've actually, speaking of like replaying games and finding new experiences and stuff, I've been finding lots of stuff in Red Dead that I have never seen before. And this is my third or fourth time playing through it, which is really cool to like still find fresh stuff in a game that you feel like you've played enough over the years and that you have figured out, you know. It feels like, it almost feels like you've found, like, you've bought DLC, and so you're like, you're familiar with the game, but you're getting to experience new stuff, but it's just stuff that was always there and you just didn't know.
Are you playing it differently? Like for me, I never hunted, for example. I literally hunted hunters, killed them, took their pelts, and that's how I hunted stuff.
No, I'm definitely hunting. Like, I'm doing like legendary animals and stuff. I'm trying to do more of the legendary fish, which is something I never, like, a lot of these checklist type quests that you have, like catching legendary fish, following the treasure maps, you know, like doing the bounty hunter, or like the requests to like hunt specific animals and mail them out to things. Like a lot of these checklists, I'd like dabbled in them, but I'd never finished them. So I think I definitely my last time I played the game did all the legendary animals hunts, but I never did all legendary fish. And it's because there's just like NPCs related to these quest lines. There are undoubtedly conversations with these NPCs when you've finished it that you have with them, and maybe they give you a thing or like a piece of like an outfit or a piece of like a trinket or something to sort of commemorate having done it, which I've never seen. So I'm keen to like see that stuff. I'm also doing a low honor playthrough, which I've never done before, which I think I mentioned on the last podcast that I was on, where I adopted the one policy from you, Matt, when you were doing your low honor playthrough, which was that nobody points a gun at Arthur Morgan and lives to tell the tale.
Hell yeah.
Which I never realized how often people will just point their guns at you. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, well, that's an awful shame. and then, you know, pop into the dead eye and put six rounds into a guy before he even hits the ground. But there's lots of stuff. I really, because I've always done a high honor playthrough, right? It's just sort of like, and I think the way the game is written as well in the story, it's sort of supposed to be a, coincidentally, a redemption story for Arthur, not a Red Dead redemption.
Whoa.
Just the way that it's written, it really comes off that way. So to do a low honor playthrough feels like non-canonical, because there's so many things that you do in that game that are, to be fair, they are optional, but it's like, your option is either like don't do it or do it to get the reward, but also you gain honor for doing it because you like helped this person. And so there's been lots of times where I've like done a mission for somebody and I gain honor and I'm like, oh god damn it, now I need to go find some like innocent people to like kill or rob or like steal their horse or stuff like that, like to like balance it out, right? There was a mission I did that was like a pretty key, it's like an optional series of missions that come off of doing one mission that you have to do in the game's main story, where it's sort of something that you do throughout multiple chapters of the game. And I just did one where it like finished off that storyline. And the last one that you do is like a very honorable ending to that storyline, no matter what the kind of Arthur you're playing. I was... So you have your like honor meter on the bottom that kind of doesn't like go down in like little ticks. It like jumps up or down in increments. So like you kind of have to do a whole bunch of bad things to get your honor to like go down to the next like tick down of, or like segment down of honor. And I was not at the very bottom, but one away from the bottom. And then I finished off the storyline just because I wanted to like get, you know, the money and like, you know, the experience and stuff and just see what would happen for characters. And then it gave me so much honor for completing it that I went back up to neutral, to pure neutral. I was right in the middle again. And I was like, I would have never realized, right? Because if I was doing an honorable playthrough and then you finish out that mission and it gives you some honor and then you jump like up to what? Maybe you get enough from doing that to max out honor. Then yeah, like that'd be like, oh sweet, like that was an honorable thing. I got a chunk of honor for it. But it put me back up to like where I started the game at. And I was
holy
like,
crap,
what am I gonna do to like lose all my honor again? Because to go on a spree in like a town, just go like shoot up a whole town or whatever, is gonna have lots of consequences. I'm gonna get a huge bounty, which means I'm always gonna have bounty hunters after me. They come in like greater and greater numbers. And you don't really get a lot for having like fought them off kind of thing. That's another kind of complaint I have about low honor Red Dead, is that the bounty hunters are, I really wish there was more of a system to the bounty hunters, because the only thing that it is like, as long as you're in a place where you have low honor, you're always being hunted essentially. And the higher your bounty, the more ridiculous like numbers of bounty hunters come after you and stuff. But it'd be kind of cool because you get like discounts at shops and you get outfit unlocks and things for having high honor, but you don't get that for having low honor, which is really stupid. So it's, again, it's like the game is really incentivizing you to be a good person. And it's like, you can lose honor if you want to, but it doesn't really affect the story that much. Although I will say the little sort of cutscenes that happen in between like major story beats where Arthur, it kind of has like Arthur having dreams or visions, that kind of thing. those do change depending on what your honor is. And so I'd only ever seen the like high honor ones before. So to be playing through the game and seeing like a low honor version of those scenes is like, oh, this is cool. Because like I imagine the vast majority of people who have played this game are not seeing this because most people aren't doing a low honor playthrough.
Has the head camp lady chewed you out yet?
Oh, for being like a bad person?
Yeah, she came up to me one time. She's like, you know what? We're supposed to be hiding out here, right, Arthur? And she's like, yeah. She's like, well, I keep hearing someone from our camp's going out there shooting and looting all the goddamn motherfuckers on the road. And then she's like, yeah. First I thought it was Micah, yeah. And now I think it's you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you are absolutely correct.
That's correct. I'm a serial killer.
Yeah, that was a funny little interaction. Again, just those like little things, right? From a low honor playthrough that most people probably wouldn't have seen. And that's kind of like why I wanted to do it, right? Because I wanted to I know a lot of people who like have a hard time being the bad guy in games. So they're like, I could never do it. I'd love to see what happens, but I can't bring myself to do it. So I'll watch you do it. So that's kind of like the sort of thing that I enjoy doing on my stream too, is like making the decisions that, you know, maybe other people are too afraid to make for the sake of just to see what happens, you know? But yeah, Remnant. Oh, and I also played, now that Remnant has crossplay between all platforms, I played with some friends that we'd always talked about playing it together before the game even came out. And then it came out and we found that it didn't have crossplay. And we were like, well, that's unfortunate. I guess we're never playing it. And then obviously the devs came out maybe like a month or two after the game launched, and they were like, we're working on crossplay. So that event that did come out at the end of last month. I think it was only like a couple weeks ago. Works really well. They really did a good job like figuring out, you know, no matter which platform you're playing with, to have a pretty smooth experience. The network for the game has gotten a lot better. We used to have like a lot of network issues trying to figure stuff out even just for stream, and I think a lot of that stuff has been pretty sorted, so that's been very enjoyable. But aside from that, I'm trying to think if there's been anything else aside from those two.
Dredge, right? You finished Dredge.
Oh yeah, totally. I put one minute into Dredge every week.
What just the title card? Like you don't click to skip. You let the title card like fully transition in, you look at it, and then
yeah, I start the timer on my phone, 60 seconds, and then I close it. Yeah. But oh, yeah,
I think put that's, the I was gonna say, you put the parental control on 1 minute of screen time, and then just it's over.
1 minute of screen time. Yeah.
Me, Michael,
that's all you, Ryan.
I finished Alan Wake 2 finally.
Hey, there
holy
you go.
Christ!
It has been completed. Great game. Highly recommend.
I've only heard really, really, really good things.
And I don't feel like it got enough. There didn't seem to be a lot of buzz about it. Just kind of when it launched, but then it quickly kind of died off. I guess that's the case with single player games, and why the WB man wants games as a service.
The WB man.
Yeah. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I like that they might be expanding that universe, that kind of Alan Wake Control universe. It's a super fun and interesting universe. And then I started Assassin's Creed Mirage.
How's that?
That game is crisp.
Crisp, you say?
It looks super crisp. I don't know what's going on. Wait, I don't know what they're doing over there. But
oh, okay.
Normally Ubisoft games, like, sure, they look nice, but they look like Ubisoft games. And this still does, don't get me wrong. But there's just something clean and crisp about it. I don't know what's going on. It's crazy.
I thought you were implying the graphics were so good that you couldn't see what was happening.
No.
That game is crisp. I don't know what's going on.
No.
Can't even tell.
But otherwise, I've been enjoying it. It's a good old Assassin's Creed. It's not breaking any new ground, but that's kind of what it was like pitched as, you know, going a little bit backwards to the classic Assassin's Creeds.
So it's similar more to like the first and then like second, like Ezio games.
Yeah,
stuff, right?
it feels it feels like a modern version of it, and so it feels really good.
Yeah,
because I tried to go back and play the first one a couple years ago, like during the pandemic, could not play it. Was not feeling it.
It's so funny because that's a perfect example of a game where, like, at the time I was like, this is so mind blowing, groundbreaking, like all this stuff. And then I played like Assassin's Creed 2 and 3 and like Brotherhood and stuff. And then I tried to go back. I tried to go back to the first one after playing Black Flag. And I was like, this is really dated. Like this is not playable anymore. And I used to think that this game was like the most mind-blowing thing.
Yeah.
And it's not even that old, you know?
And I don't know when Mirage is supposed to come out for iOS, but that'll be interesting to see how that looks and runs there. The one unfortunate part is I think I have it running at 60 FPS, but the cutscenes are 30 FPS. And it's
really?
Like, yeah, and so you always get like this weird, you know, disconnect.
That's odd.
By design?
Yeah, because I think they're not necessarily pre-rendered cutscenes, but they're, I guess, rendered in 30 FPS.
That's really bizarre.
I mean, it's the case for a couple games, but I don't know.
I guess I haven't checked.
It's during specific cutscenes, though, not all of them.
Oh, that's even worse. What? It's not even consistent? I feel like they should lean into it at that point and just go 24, make it like cinematic.
Yeah. Get the ultra wide screen. Not ultra wide screen, but cinematic wide screen.
Put it in letterboxing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. That's all we got, Tim. Where are they watching you play your evil
Red,
man?
The Reds and the Red Dead
Redemption.
The unusual man at twitch.tv/thesidetrack. It's been a lot of fun, man. Like, I spent the whole stream today just like doing side objectives. Like literally just no story, anything, just hunting and fishing and all just like random side stuff. And it was just like some of the most ridiculous shit happened. I was trying to do like bandit challenges. So I was trying to rob people on the road. And this one person like ran away from me on a wagon and they were like gunning it. Like they were like continually like, yeah, yeah, like cracking the reins for the horses to go. And then they went over a train track and just like the physics of the wagon going over the train tracks at high speed, it like the horse went up and back down and then the wagon just launched in the air and like came back down again.
Jeez.
And just like it's just like the constant ridiculous stuff that happens is always such a treat.
I was gonna actually ask you, do you ever feel bad for having to shoot somebody? Like, I remember Seamus pulled a gun on me and I heard him do it as I was turning around. I was like, god damn it, up and just boom, there goes Seamus. I guess, like, fuck.
Yeah, definitely. Like there's every time when I had like bounties on me, and the bounty hunters, when you get to a certain level, I think it's like when you have a bounty of $300 or more, they start to bring like hunting dogs, and so the hunting dogs are running up and I'm like, I don't want to have to fucking shoot these dogs with my shotgun, but like they're gonna mess me up. Like I have to do it because the dogs are no joke. And I'm just like, I'm sorry, boy. Everyone look away. I gotta put them down. Like, yeah. So, but
and, we'll be streaming something. Twitch.tv/JamePatchMedia Wednesdays 9 p.m. Eastern. All right,
I'll stream you.
I'm getting out of here.
That's scary.
Good night, everyone. We'll see you guys next time.
Peace.